This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile Apple website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, why NASA is now legally obliged to land on Europa, Wired meets J.J. Abrams, and we find out what Britain's first visitor to ISS has been up to in his first week in space. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me are James Temperton.
Hello.
And Emily Reynolds.
Hi.
Everyone's a little bit worse for the wear this morning. It was Wired's Christmas party last night.
It's true. I drank far too much seaweed juice.
That's traditional at Wired. We don't drink alcohol. We just drink various derived liquids from insects, plants, space rocks, that type of stuff. Unfortunately, Emily, you were left behind.
No, I was ostracized.
But you got to eat a giant gingerbread man.
I did. I was placated temporarily by biscuit offering.
Yeah, I think a festive mood. Because this is our last podcast of the year.
More or less, yeah. I mean, there's always a chance we'll manage to get one out on Tuesday, but I very much doubt it, given the scale of the stuff we have to actually get done. So, yeah, this is going to be the last one before the end of the year. And then you and I, James, are off to CES in Las Vegas.
It's going to be wild.
Yeah. So we may try and do a podcast from Las Vegas. That seems like a added complication we should definitely try to do.
Yep.
But it won't be until, God, the second week in January where we're actually back on the podcast. So sorry for the extended break. But there'll be lots of news to talk about when we get back. So.
And wow, what a show we've got coming up, Michael.
And what a show. First, though, we've all learned something this week. Emily, what have you learned?
I've learned that if you fire a laser pulse at the neuron in the thalamus of a rat, it will wake it up if it's sleeping.
Oh. It's, like, practical and interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned that this week the most concrete blocks smashed while holding an egg is 24, achieved by Joe Alexander of Germany. And this man also holds the record for the most arrows caught within 2 minutes, 43.
How did he smash the block while he was holding the egg? What was he smashing the block with?
With the hand that was holding the egg.
Wow, that is impressive.
Oh, so he wasn't just holding an egg in another hand and
no.
Smashing
it. He smashed it with the hand in which the egg was held.
That's pretty impressive.
Incredibly impressive.
So I learned that American heterosexual men who spend more than $2,000 on a wedding ring are more likely to end up divorced than men who spend less. That's according to a study by Emory University in Atlanta.
I guess that's something to do with wealth as well as just how much you decide to spend on a ring.
Yeah, there's another bit to the study that says, I think, that you're one third more likely to have a shorter marriage if you spend more than $20,000 on your wedding.
Depressing and enjoyable. So this week, we got final confirmation about NASA's budget for 2016. And the amazing thing is that it's actually good news. It's more than they asked for. So NASA, historically, at least since the demise of the Apollo program, has been historically underfunded, at least if you're NASA or someone who conducts space or has any interest in space or science or pretty much anything that's outside of our planet. But this week, they actually got very good news with some caveats, which we'll get onto. But it's worth just kind of running through what NASA has been granted, because it could mean some very significant things for missions in the near future.
So what's the total pot that they're going to get?
$19.3 billion. And that's $1.3 billion more than in 2015.
And this is dollars?
Dollars.
Yep.
And $756 million more than requested by President Obama, which is a fantastic thing, really, for NASA to not have to be fighting so hard for every stretch of duct tape that it needs to conduct its missions. But most interestingly, perhaps, of that budget, and there's lots of different parts of NASA, and that sounds like a lot of money, but actually, in context, it's not a huge amount of money. But maybe the most interesting thing that comes out of it concerns Europa. Europa is a moon of Jupiter covered in ice, which has been one of the prime candidates for perhaps being able to host life within our solar system, which is fantastically exciting.
Space crocodiles, basically.
Maybe, or maybe just tiny bacteria or something that can exist within its oceans, which are heated, I think, by the gravity of Jupiter more than the sun, because they're under so much ice. But
space octopus?
Maybe space octopus.
Okay.
Space squid. Any space version of an aquatic animal you could think of. Probably.
But there's an interesting caveat to the Europa mission.
Right. So NASA has always wanted to go to Europa because it's a fantastically interesting world, but landing on it is incredibly hard because we've never been there before. We don't really know much about its surface, and it's going to cost a huge amount of money. But so they've been allocated $1.63 billion for its planetary science division, but that includes $175 million designated for this Europa mission on the proviso that they land, which makes it illegal, technically, to plan a Europa mission that doesn't have a lander attached.
So Congress has said, you can go there, but you have to land and you have to find us something interesting.
Yeah, more or less. And this is all thanks to, Texas Congressman John Culberson, who chairs the House Appropriations Subcommittee with jurisdiction over the Space Agency. Now, he is someone who has a very long-standing commitment to the idea of alien life being discovered within our solar system. He believes it exists, and he encourages NASA very strongly to go out and find it. The problem is that NASA's administrator, Charles Bolden, has said previously that landing on Europa is a terrible idea, that it would make any kind of early science we do much more difficult and the mission much more expensive, and potentially hold it back from launching in the relatively near future. But this amount of money means that NASA has to start planning now for a mission to put together a detailed plan for a potential launch around 2022, including a lander. Now, it will probably be a mission that circles Europa about 20 times and then attempts to land, a little bit like the Rosetta mission to the comet recently. So the lander wouldn't be the number one thing it would do. That would just kind of maybe almost be an added bonus, but it's really exciting.
Yeah, and this wouldn't be the first time, of course, that we've landed on the surface of another planet's moon. We sent, Cassini-Huygens that went to Titan and landed on the surface, took an amazing picture, conducted some remarkable science. So it has been done before.
Yeah, I think we knew more about Titan or the surface of Titan than we do about Europa. Europa is icy. There are huge chunks and shards and ice mountains all over the place, potentially ice volcanoes, maybe even some kind of liquid. We don't know much about really what it's like there, so landing is incredibly hard.
Well, good luck to them.
Yeah,
there was also some things about sending humans further into space and new NASA rockets.
Yeah, so the Space Launch System, this is the successor to the Constellation program that was in the early 2000s, the mission to try and get back to the moon and then Mars. The Space Launch System, though, is NASA's future its future ticket to back to the moon and to Mars now. So it's going to be the most powerful rocket since the Saturn V, potentially 20% more powerful than that rocket, can lift 130 tons in its maximum configuration. Hugely exciting, and it's been funded, at least for next year. So Obama requested $1.36 billion, and Congress provided $2 billion. So that's great.
Yeah.
And that plans to launch in 2018. Commercial crew, so NASA's plan to replace or get off reliance on Russia's Soyuz craft, which of course provided Tim Peake's ticket to the ISS earlier this week, has also been given some critical funding, which means that's likely to go ahead. The Earth Science Division, perhaps less exciting to some people, but the division of NASA that looks at our own planet, talks about weather and how our atmosphere changes and global warming and how that process is continuing. That's also been given some critical funding. And even the Space Technology Mission Directorate, which is a slightly mysterious part of NASA that looks at very cutting-edge technology to potentially form the basis of new missions, even that's been given almost the money that it asked for. Historically, one of the most critically underfunded parts of NASA. That's a little bit more of a complex story. All the details of that are on our website. But the key is it's got some money to do some really, really vital science.
There's one weird bit of bad news.
Yeah, so in true American political style, this budget, the budget's always a completely complex, hideous thing to try and get through Congress and then through signed into law by the president. And so one of the things Congress often does is attach other bills to it in order so that they pass more easily, particularly controversial legislation. And in this case, a critical piece of security and privacy legislation has been attached to the budget. This is CISA, or the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. This was passed by the Senate in October, but has been hugely criticized by privacy groups, technology companies, for the relationship it builds between agencies like the CIA and the FBI and private companies who have to hand over their data, particularly how it cuts out the middleman, which would provide some oversight. And that bill has been included as part of the budget.
So it's a mission to Europa and a back channel to get at my Twitter direct messages.
More or less, yeah. I mean, I think that they are two separate issues. I think the decision to fund NASA is obviously unrelated to the privacy stuff, but it's something that you have to kind of be aware of, that in this moment of relative joy, really, about NASA being secured at least for the next year, there's also this darker side of CISA, which obviously doesn't affect us directly here in the UK, but actually might, considering how much of our data is held by US companies. And it also contributes to this sort of ongoing discussion about privacy and security that we're going through here in the UK.
It's a weird old world.
It really is. But, you know, it's a weirder world on Europa, and we're going there now. So that's
nice.
very exciting.
Yeah.
Emily, you've had a weird old time on another world, on the internet.
I have, and it's all because of a study by the Pew Research Center into public perception of gaming. So they conducted this research, and there were lots of interesting stats that came out of it. For example, 26% of adults think video games are a complete waste of time.
26% of adults are wrong.
Yep. 4 in 10 adults think gaming is related to violent behavior, and probably least surprisingly, people who play games are much more likely to agree with positives associated with gaming and disagree with the negatives. But the most interesting, or maybe contentious rather than interesting, area of the research looked into the kind of gender perceptions towards gaming and the people who play games.
And the background to this, obviously, is about 18 months or more of extremely contentious and mean-spirited discussion on the internet about all of those issues. And obviously, anytime you decide to report on that, you're going to get some blowback, as you did this week. But just talk us through what the report actually said.
So the study found that just as many women as men play games. So 48% of women regularly play games compared to 50% of men, which is obviously a negligible difference. But public opinion still kind of heavily skews towards men. People still think that gaming is kind of a solely male pursuit, rather than something that women are also interested in.
And this is the people themselves as well. So if you ask a man and a woman if they're a gamer, you get really different results.
Yeah, so 15% of men considered themselves gamers, which is compared to 6% of women. But there was no actual definition of what gamer meant. So there's obviously interesting discussion to be had about how people relate to the term gamer, as opposed to
sitting in your underpants playing Fallout for hours and hours and hours.
But we all relate to that, surely.
That is the most comfortable way to play Fallout.
Right.
Speaking from experience. I guess, did the report specifically go into what types of games people play, or whether these are mobile games or console games?
It was console, PC, handheld devices, everything. Mm-hmm. So that's probably skewed it as well, because women play more games on the smartphone, but often they're not considered to be gaming in the same way that someone playing a PC is.
Which is, you know, a purely artificial division, considering the complexity of games on mobile phones, but also that ultimately you're pushing buttons to make pixels move around. It doesn't really matter if you're playing Fallout or Candy Crush or whatever it is. You know,
well, it kind of does.
I don't think it
does. Not all pixels are equal.
I think they are.
Different. It would be like saying you're watching a brilliant film, you're watching a terrible film.
Yeah, I think that's still the same activity, more or less.
Sure. One has more merit than the other. So we also found that there's still, kind of obviously, I suppose, this very nasty, very small section of the internet that latch onto things like this and do some unpleasant things with them.
Yeah, so when I tweeted the story, I got a lot of responses from gamergaters who hate women, apparently. Obviously, it's a very small minority of people who consider themselves gamers. Like, the vast majority of people who play games don't hate women. But there is a very loud and vocal and very present online section of gamers. And I think that aspect of it is probably why a lot of women don't identify as gamers, because they're reluctant to engage with that kind of violent language.
And this unrepresentative voice is so over-amplified. It's such a small number of people, and they're effectively just all shouting at each other in a room on the internet.
Yeah, they're
on Twitter
relentless.
And they're on certain forums, but there's not many of them compared to the vast majority of people who couldn't give a flying what's it about what gender someone is and whether they're playing a video game or not.
I think the other difficult thing is that this GameGate is one of those things that developed now for so long that it's also drawn in people who didn't see or don't see some of that violent language or some of the abuse, and more focus on issues like, again, the ethics of video games journalism, but see it as see that as isolated from the abusive side, which I think is more difficult if you're in the position of actually being on the receiving end of it, as you were.
But to go back to the study, why would so many much fewer women consider themselves to be gamers than men? Why is that skewed like that?
I think maybe it's just the general public perception, or the marketing of games, or again, like the Gamergate thing. It's just how women perceive their place in gaming.
Yeah, and maybe what people see as gaming.
Yeah,
right.
Again,
so the difference between playing Candy Crush on the bus or sitting down for 3 hours to play Uncharted.
Yeah,
I think it builds into wider culture as well. I mean, the most popular video games that sell every Christmas are FIFA, and you know, football is one of those things that has done some good work actually to be more diverse, but still appeals to a lot of boys, you know.
Yeah, the marketing is very, very male. Even
but football as a whole, I mean, this is the thing. And the same thing with Call of Duty, which is obviously the usually the second biggest selling game at Christmas.
Yeah.
also has done more to appeal to female gamers. You can now play as a woman in Call of Duty and all of that. But it's still playing as soldiers, I think, culturally has been one of those things that boys and young men like to do more than women for whatever reason. I think it's sometimes to do with, you know, how people collect in different places and why people group together in certain places.
And they're the sort of things that parents are more likely to buy for boys. Games consoles and manly video games. They're still gendered amongst the older people who are going to be parents. Although, as you said, Call of Duty, the advert does go after female gamers. An awful lot of the PS4 adverts at the moment have sort of boys and girls in equal measure. So there's a little bit of progress.
But I think it's the kind of thing that can change as well. Like, you know, this week we've been dominated by the release of Star Wars, but that hasn't, either in the types of people talking about it, the people who are excited about it, the people in the movie or the people making it, doesn't seem like a thing that's a male thing. Even though in the past, Star Wars used to be what's perceived as one of the preserves of that kind of male nerdery.
And nobody in this room has seen it.
No, not yet.
Which so is terrible.
We cannot speak in an informed way about that movie yet. So, I mean, you know, I guess the other thing is the term gamer, which is an incredibly contentious thing. In fact, Gamergate as a whole pretty much kickstarted with an editorial about the definition of that word. And I think in some ways that's one of those things that people who consider themselves gamers talk to other people who consider themselves gamers in that very specific way.
Yeah.
And that term just doesn't naturally occur to anyone else who might play video games.
I don't think it's necessarily a particularly useful term. And, you know, if you enjoy video games and you want to sit there for 8 hours in your pants playing Fallout, doesn't matter whether you call yourself a gamer or not. So,
but it won't develop culturally until this very nasty little subset shuts up or we're able to ignore it. But it's quite hard.
They won't shut up. I know this from experience from this week. They keep on going, days and days.
Which is a shame. But, you know, I do think, there is a broadening awareness amongst developers and the very big video games companies that there's a much bigger audience for their entertainment out there than this relatively small group of people. And, you know, it really feels like a lot of these big new IPs like Destiny or Star Wars Battlefront, you know, obviously all of the stuff Nintendo is doing, although we don't know what they're going to really be doing next year, but all of that stuff is it appeals, I think, to more people, isn't gendered in a way that perhaps video games used to be. So I think it's opening up, and I think over time, you know, the more people that play mobile video games, the more people there are going to be who transition over to consoles or PCs or whatever, and also those devices are going to blur eventually, that mobile games are going to become equivalent to console games. Again, with Nintendo, perhaps as soon as next year. So, it really could, I think, combine in a more organic way than we might expect.
So if we come back to this study in a couple of years, maybe it will be less gendered.
Let's hope so.
And also less age focused as well. You know, the amount of people who play games is typically skewed younger. But I think we're going to see people, you know, large numbers of people in the next few decades in their 60s, 70s and 80s playing video games too.
Right, when you're 60, 70 or 80.
I'll still be playing Fallout. I'm never going to get through that game. Yeah, 2050 is, I think, when I'm going to complete that. Now, James, the biggest story for us this week in terms of traffic, if nothing else, has been the travails of Tim Peake. So why don't you tell us about what his first week on the ISS has been like?
He's had a pretty good week.
It's not bad, is it?
It's from something like from 0 to 17,000 kilometres per hour in the space of like 6 or 7 hours. It's pretty rapid acceleration.
Yeah, he actually made orbit in about 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is not bad.
Yeah, and I find out that each seat in the Soyuz capsule is individually moulded to the astronaut. So because space there is so, so tight, each astronaut has this mould made of them so that they sit very comfortably in the seat when this thing is shaking up into orbit. Which is kind of neat. So there's this picture of Tim Peake having a mould made of his body so that he can have a really comfy seat for his... Because they're in the tiny little capsule for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think in this case they were there for about 8 hours, but it's been several days in the past.
Yeah, it's been a couple of days to catch up with the orbit. Mm. So yes, he's had a very fun first week in space. And as Kara was writing about this morning, Kara's not here, she's just behind that wall. but he had a very British week in space. So in his first tweet, he thanked Commander Yuri Malachenko for the outstanding job he did docking safely with the ISS.
To be fair, he did have to do that manually, which is not easy.
Yeah, and apparently Chris Hadfield, the Canadian astronaut who went up, explained that very often they'll just do it by measuring with their thumbs.
Yeah, it's really something. But you could hear, as they were trying to do that, you could hear over the radio talking about the size of the little catchment area, which they know is a certain physical size, and then measuring that and seeing how far they are. It's really a knockout.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So after he'd thanked someone, he then apologised for being slow to reply to Elton John, who had sent him a good luck message. Peake explained that he'd been unable to reply because he was going to space.
That's a pretty good excuse.
It's so good. It was something along the lines of, sorry, I couldn't reply. I was already in the Soyuz on my way to space.
But it seemed genuine, like he was, you know, concerned that Elton might be offended.
I mean, how many times do you get a message from Elton John congratulating you? You know, so he then thanked the Queen, thanked her Madge,
obviously,
which was an important thing to do. And over the last couple of days, he's tweeted to say he's found the stash of tea, which he was very relieved about. And his first meal aboard the International Space Station was a hot bacon sandwich.
I love Tim Peake. I really love him. I think he's, you know, proving to be slightly boring, but in that way that all astronauts are slightly boring. But I really think there's like a nice sort of homely
safe.
British
very
safe.
Safe.
Yeah, yeah, I think he's great.
In a wonderful way. So the music he went up with was very popular Kasabian, Coldplay, Queen,
very
U2.
Diplomatic way of putting it.
Yeah. It was lame.
People love this music, right? So he represents a vast swathe of Britishness. He's sort of chivalrous and heroic and
like
ginger and quite quiet. And
slightly boring. He's like a space Tim Henman. That's kind of how I think about him. You know, like he's not necessarily going to win the championship, but he's going to give it a good old go. Like it's going to take a while for his personality, I think, to come across. It's probably a little bit of a shocking experience to find yourself in ISS. But, you know, soon enough he'll be posting sort of pictures from the cupola of Earth from space and everyone will start to love him.
Yeah, doing comedy skits and stuff.
Well, we've got 6 months to catch up with him.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing I found out this week is Heston Blumenthal has made a customised 7-course banquet for him, which is going to be revealed in a BBC documentary in the spring. But that includes a very, very special cup of tea, which has only been trailed slightly at the moment, but apparently it's going to be the greatest cup of tea ever drunk.
Wow.
And that's an achievement, isn't it, for a British person in space?
Yeah, to drink the best cup of tea ever while hurtling around the Earth at 17,000 kilometres an hour. So I also looked up some fun ISS facts. It's been continually occupied since November 2000. So you think, all that time, there has been at least one person not on this planet. Continually. It's kind of astonishing. It's
and one of those things that isn't going to be the case for too much longer. ISS is only really currently funded up to 2024. Maximum is 2028 before it has to crash back down to Earth. And NASA said last week it's not going to replace it in low Earth orbit. They want to go back to the moon and possibly further beyond. So unless private companies step up and build a space station of their own, or China happens to do it, that's probably going to end. This is a golden period for having humans in space. And
golden era.
No, but it's not going to be true forever. So
no,
really
you won't be able to.
It.
You won't be able to look up and think that there are 6 or 7 people that should be on this rock that aren't. It's remarkable. Its internal volume, the ISS, is pretty much the same as a Boeing 747. And if you were to put it down on Earth, it would be about the same size as an American football field. I think it's a little bit longer, but still, it's pretty big.
It's pretty big. Yeah.
Yeah. 221 people from 18 different countries have visited the International Space Station. So the UK now joins the US, Russia, Japan, Canada, Italy, France, Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, Sweden, Brazil, Denmark, Kazakhstan, Malaysia, South Africa, South Korea, and Spain.
How many of those were women, James?
33.
That's not great.
Well, no, it's not tremendous. And most of them are Americans or Russians. So of the 221 people who have visited the ISS, of which Tim Peake is now one, 33 were women and 7 were tourists. 80 people have been twice, lucky them. 28 people have been 3 times. 5 people have been 4 times. And Yuri Malachenko, the commander on Tim Peake's launch, who did a terribly good job docking with the ISS, has now visited a record 5 times.
Do you think it's boring at that point?
It's too many times.
Yeah. Do you think it's just like going, you know, back to your parents for Christmas? It's like, you know, it's nice, but...
I guess. Yeah. I mean, some people haven't even flown in a plane 5 times. A lot of people haven't.
True. And how much does the ISS cost?
They reckon the European Space Agency put it at about $100 billion, which would make it the most expensive structure ever made by man, or anyone maybe, who knows, there might be space alligators who have got this wicked moon base on Europa.
All right, enough of the space alligators. I mean, it's one of those things. I think it was nice this week that so much focus was placed on something that is ultimately relatively mundane, a launch to the ISS. It's one of those things that if it's just some NASA astronauts or Russian cosmonauts, we tend to kind of just ignore. We assume it's going to be fine. But particularly this year, in which a number of craft which have been sending supplies, obviously unmanned, to the ISS have exploded, and that journey didn't seem so mundane or so routine anymore. It really was quite nerve-wracking, but also really inspiring to see someone who kids especially can relate to get to the ISS. The BBC filled the Science Museum with thousands of school children.
It was amazing
watching that launch. But you know, looking back on that footage after it happened, even knowing it was safe, it was nerve-wracking. What if something had gone wrong? You know, but I think it's going to be proved to be hugely inspiring for those kids.
Yeah, and the YGK podcast has a pretty international audience. So from those countries that I listed out, there's probably some people listening right now. And you've all had people in space. This is, well, so have we, but we've never had one on the ISS. And this is a really, really big moment for British science. As I said on the last podcast, when I waxed lyrical about Tim Peake, it's going to enable kids to conduct experiments in space, to sit in your classroom and have a Skype call with someone in space. I could imagine as a kid and as someone that is still ridiculously fascinated by space, that that could be a really, really formative moment. So super exciting. 6 months of a lovely British man in space drinking tea and eating bacon sarnies.
And just to round it off, obviously, as was pointed out rightly, all week, Helen Sharman was the first British person in space. She flew to the Mir space station, I think, for about 8 days.
Just a holiday, really.
In 1991. But there's actually a very good video, which you'll be able to find on our YouTube page and on our Twitter page, of Tim Peake being interviewed by Helen Sharman at Wired Next Gen 2014. And it's a really interesting conversation. There's no... You know, I think maybe some people have perceived some animosity or some tension between, you know, who was the first, but they're really, really friendly with each other, and it's a really fun, relaxed conversation. So it's worth checking out. So that can be found on our YouTube page. Still to come, this week has been dominated by the release of Star Wars: The Force Awakens, and Wired's Ollie Franklin Wallace recently sat down with director J.J. Abrams to talk about the movie with no spoilers attached. We absolutely promise that. And we've got some exclusive audio from that interview coming up next, along with a short chat with Ollie about the movie, which he's already seen, so we can get his take on how the movie compares to the rest of the Star Wars franchise. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more, all with a single integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/widenews. We can't wait to see what you make of it. So in a week dominated by real space travel, unfortunately, the media somewhat has been consumed by fake space travel. Star Wars: The Force Awakens finally reaches cinemas this weekend. But we're joined by Wired's Ollie Franklin Wallace, who wrote this month's cover story on J.J. Abrams and everything Star Wars, to find out both what you thought of the movie, Ollie, and what you thought about the conversation with J.J. Abrams.
No spoilers.
So the spoiler-free review, Star Wars: The Force Awakens. It's great. I'm so delighted to be able to say that after months and months, not only of anticipation, but also of having put together Wired's big Star Wars special, which is out this month on the newsstands. If you haven't read it, my interview with JJ is also up on wired.co.uk, so pause right now and go read it.
Was the movie satisfying as well as a good movie? Like, was it enough to justify the hype? Or
I think so. I think it does a very... it does a very good job of kind of fulfilling all of your expectations and what you know and love for Star Wars. Like it hits all of those nostalgia points, and there's lots of little quotes and references here and there. But it's also full of great new stuff. You know, Daisy Ridley, who plays Rey, who's the new heroine, is fantastic. And Adam Driver, who plays Kylo Ren, who's like the new... well, he's not a Sith, but he's like the heir to Darth Vader. He carries that cool cross lightsaber that everyone kind of freaked out about. Is amazingly... interesting and has lots of backstory that I think is going to be really interesting watching it play out in the rest of this trilogy and the millions of other spin-off kind of films and TV shows and everything that I'm sure are coming because it's Disney and they don't do anything by halves these days.
Well, I guess that's the other element to this, isn't it? This is the beginning rather than the end of a hype train. You know, this is just going to get bigger. There are going to be movies every year from now on, one day more than one a year. Like, it feels like this is the start of something very, very big rather than the end of 6 months of hype.
Oh yeah, this is like the new world order that we live in where there'll be a Star Wars movie at least every year, and I'm sure there'll be a million other ways that you'll be seeing Star Wars. It is inescapable, but thankfully it is good, and I think everyone who loves Star Wars, which is pretty much everyone, right? Apart from you, James, because you're a heretic.
Sure, why not? I'm indifferent to it.
Yeah, how can you be... Oh.
Should it be like Marmite? Should I either love it or hate it?
You work at Wired, man. You've got to embrace it.
I think that's the problem. I think every other post we've done this month has been Star Wars related.
So. Yeah, I apologize.
And we've killed his
spirit.
We're
now going to have a month off Star Wars.
But so you managed to actually sit down with J.J. Abrams, the man who single-handedly, it sounds like, has saved Star Wars as a concept. What was it like actually meeting him?
I did. It was great. I think J.J. Abrams is the perfect director for this film. He's an absolute Star Wars nerd, and he's had some success in kind of reviving franchises in the past, with Star Trek, obviously. But yeah, I sat down with him earlier this year, during the summer, to talk a little bit about the making of the film. He talked a little bit about the props and going back to the practical effects. There are no spoilers in the interview, which, you know, just in case you're worried. And he also gave me a few little sneak peeks off the record, which was very exciting at the time. But having now seen that, you can see, and having now seen the film, I think you can see the love and the kind of craft in what he's talking about, and it really shines through in the finished film. So I hope you all enjoy it and send me a tweet and think. oh, and my review's up, so if you... if you want to have a discussion with me on Twitter, then yeah, send me a tweet.
Great, and to talk about it. Obviously our Star Wars episode 8 preview coverage starts next week with a full... just joking, honestly, just joking. Not yet. Great.
Not funny, man. Not funny.
I was raised to do one thing. But I've got nothing to fight for.
Nothing will stand in our way. Finish what you started.
You've talked a lot in previous interviews about, you know, the power of the used universe as being one of the secrets of one of the original films. You know, it's something people talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. But it struck me that you see that teaser and you see some of this imagery and the concept of the used universe changes slightly, because now you're 30 years since the original, and every little scratch and every object in the background, suddenly the used universe has a story that's mm-hmm. connecting it to the previous movie and what happened. So everything has layers of meaning, mm-hmm. unintended or not. So how much attention do you have to pay to those tiny little details, and knowing that fans, especially with a Star Wars movie, they're going to imbue everything with a sense of, you know, vital importance?
This is such a sort of holographic experience, and what I mean by that is that every little piece feels like it is reflected in the whole. That what you're describing is true in the material, the visuals, what you see, but it's also true in the history of the characters in the movie. Meaning that everything that they are is built upon and standing on the shoulders of the history of these movies that have come before it, and how those things got there, not necessarily just a Star Destroyer crashed in the desert, but also what's the history, the legacy of Vader. You know, we were in the room when his mask came off, but there were only two people that we know of in that space when he saved his son. And what is his legacy, and who reported that, and is he seen as we see him, or is he seen as a martyr? Is he a cautionary tale? Is he something to aspire to? You know, the idea of what has come before and how has it decayed and entropied, or rather atrophied or in, you know, been distorted or been incorporated or been admired or disparaged or whatever it is, the fascinating thing for me was what has transpired between what we know and what is. And there's going to be a young generation of characters in this movie who have not seen Star Wars. They have maybe heard about it. They may live in a place that resembles it. They may have some pre-existing knowledge, but they've never seen Star Wars. And the idea of what does that generation know, and what about the young characters who find themselves smack dab in the center of the Star Wars adventure, who don't expect it, aren't prepared for it, but find themselves as absolutely desperate as any character that's ever been in Star Wars. And desperation, to me, is the key quality that every character in Star Wars has. That, to me, was a thrilling way in.
You say desperation. That's interesting. One of the other things that, again, I haven't really read a lot about, but to me is like part of the DNA of mm-hmm. the original movies is comedy, and in the characters of 3PO.
What's funnier than desperation?
And R2. Oh, I guess so, yeah.
I mean, 3PO is maybe the most desperate character in the movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, Han Solo is desperate to make money. Luke's desperate to get the fuck off that farm. Leia's desperate to get the plans to her father. Vader's desperate to get those plans back from the rebellion. I mean, everyone is desperate. And it is the desperation that makes for some of the funniest moments in the movie. You know, Han accepting this job because he's desperate to pay back, you know, Jabba. That's not... That's like perfect comedy, you know, and it's it, you know, his desperation is what makes him decide he's going to try and help save the princess, you know, and then their desperation when they're all together in the middle of that trash compactor. It's like it is a series of absolutely extreme, ridiculous desperation moments. But I will say that without question, when I've been asked again and again and again already, what is the fundamental element to this movie or to Star Wars for you? My answer is always that it is a movie that had such incredible humor and was built on the humanity, the heart, the, you know, the relatability and the desperation of these characters. But it is the comedy of, you know, not just the droids and not just Leia's attitude or Han's attitude, but there was a kind of, you know, the humanity and the humor are hand in hand. It really, the heart of that movie was so remarkable. And yes, the music was incredible. Yes, the visuals were amazing. Yes, the technology was incredible. Yeah, I mean, everything that George did right is, it's winning the lottery. I mean, it's an impossibility, the odds that he succeeded in that. But it was, the humor was the thing that was the way in, that was the... It was a way of telling a story that was robust and fairly simple, but incredibly, beautifully, funnily well told.
Tell me about how you strike that balance between capturing the feel of the original while also wanting to be, you know, Star Wars movies have a history of pushing boundaries, so you must be also tempted to do that. And
well, the thing about this movie going in, I knew it was going to be, you know, there are going to be thousands of CG shots in the film. The work that ILM is doing, that Roger Gayette, our visual effects supervisor, is doing, is groundbreaking. I mean, they're using, you know, technically, for anyone who cares, they're using, you know, simulations and things that haven't been done before, and they're working on all sorts of techniques to realize things that are happening partly because we did as much as we could, not with CG, which is to say, we desperately wanted there to be a standard of reality and authenticity so that everything that was CG, that was required to be CG, had something to adhere to and a standard that it needed to achieve. And the fun of being in this moment on this movie was, the inspiration was, and the master we were serving was, that feeling I had, Kathy had, Larry Kasdan had, watching those original films, despite now certain things, seeing matte lines and garbage mats and all sorts of, you know, of course, we can look at it now and go, oh my God, look at that. But when you are in the middle of Tatooine and you're seeing those bones along the dunes, or you're, you know, looking out at the binary sunset, like the amazing thing that they put in another setting sun there, but there's no question that is a human being standing in an actual desert location. When you're on the frozen planet of Hoth, when you're in the, you know, the forest of Endor, like again and again and again, there were examples of a physical, tangible reality. And the brilliance of what George did was in part using actual, practical, real scale so judiciously that you would then buy things that were illusions. He was the ultimate magician in being able to know exactly where your eye was looking when he would, you know, palm the coin and make you believe it was in the other hand. And to do that while at the same time have the kind of humor and humanity and rhythm and scope. I mean, it was just an incredible juggling act. But for us, we knew we would have every tool in the toolbox at our disposal. The beauty was we chose to invest in as much practical stuff as we could, which, while it wasn't necessarily less expensive, it was enormously valuable for the actors, for camera, for the look of the movie, and it allowed us to create characters and sets and locations and props and interactions and light and explosions and things that added a level of authenticity to it that I think is maybe not always quantifiable, but without question felt and tangible and ultimately hugely important. So for example, if you look at the first movies, they didn't have lightsabers that lit up when they were doing those films. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the lighting, there's of course no interactive lighting. There wouldn't be, you know. Does it mean that those scenes aren't among the greatest scenes ever filmed? No. But it was an amazing thing to see our prop department create these ridiculously powerful lightsaber props that would allow us to do scenes where there was interactive lighting. And what that did was things that we could never have anticipated and probably wouldn't have even replicated in CG if we hadn't done it like this, but where you literally can see the light not just on the characters' faces and on their clothing, but in their eyes in a way that is just an amazing thing to see. Small detail. Does it make a scene good? No. But is it a wonderful piece of reality to have on your side? Yes. You know, having, as you saw in the behind-the-scenes featurette that we put out at Comic-Con, we had the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon, and it was outdoors on a gimbal. We didn't have to do it outdoors or on a gimbal. The only reason we did that was we knew you can't copy sunlight. You can't fake it. You can get pretty close, and maybe no one will even really know. But there's one thing to have a big, you know, BB light on a dolly moving back and forth. It's another thing to actually have sunlight. I will just tell you, when you see the sequence of her in that cockpit flying, the light that is interacting with her is sunlight, and it just simply looks better. When we're outside in the forest in Wales on the ice in Iceland, when we're at the Skellig, you know, Michael, mm-hmm. in Ireland, when we're, you know, filming even at Pinewood, when we built, you know, sets, exterior sets, we actually were, you know, at scale outdoors, even that scene where you see the rally of the First Order, you know, we could have done that interior somewhere, but we shot it outdoors with enormous scope, crazy big cranes. And of course, we filled in the vast majority of the characters and extended the set. But it was amazing how much actually was physical and real. Mm. So in shots where we're moving behind all these stormtroopers, they were there. We had hundreds of stormtroopers. And of course, we didn't have, you know, 100,000. But we had enough that it was able to give the movie a reality. And I will shut up in a second. But being able to use CG to remove things instead of adding things, you know, getting rid of puppeteers, getting rid of, you know, arms and controls and strings and legs of people that were under creatures. And it was priceless to be able to be in Abu Dhabi in a real desert with five guys inside a hopabore, you know, costume, this giant beast, and being able to have, you know, in between takes, they would shove an air conditioning unit, you know, basically up its ass just to kind of cool the guys down so they didn't die, and in 125 degree heat. But you had this, you know, physical, tangible creature that was right there that John Boyega could interact with. And could it have worked otherwise? Of course, we've all seen a million movies that have done that. But by having it be physical and real, I would argue it made that moment and that scene better. You didn't even think about it not being real. Mm. And that's the difference, is that it might work, but when you can just accept it, it gets you deeper and deeper into it. And none of this makes it a good movie, but all this can prevent it from being a bad one.
as a like a lifelong fan of those movies, directing the original cast, then you've also got this young cast of incredibly talented actors.
Mm-hmm.
How do you treat those the kind of established cast without? How do you direct them without treating them with reverence and treating them differently?
It's a great question. The key to doing this movie for me, and I think I share this exact sentiment with everyone in the crew, was to acknowledge, embrace, accept, and appreciate your fandom and your love of this world, and then put it in your pocket and keep it as a wonderful reminder, but don't wield it, don't look at it, don't lead with it. I couldn't be on the set and be a fanboy. I needed to be a director. Harrison, Carrie, Mark, Anthony, Peter, none of the original actors wanted a fanboy to work with. They all needed someone who would give them criticism, feedback, notes, ideas, a response to what was happening. And so while there are moments constantly and every day where I would almost find myself gasping that it was happening, I would have to suppress that and do the job required, because no one, and certainly not the movie, would benefit from my being blinded by the love of Star Wars. That doesn't help make a movie good, and I would argue it could possibly guarantee failure. So luckily the work was and needed to be primary. And there were nights where I would go back home. I was staying at the Chiltern Firehouse. And I would go back to my little room there and fall down on the bed and just think, holy shit, we just did this thing today. We just shot this chase sequence in the Falcon today. We just had this moment where Han and Chewie arrived for the first time. You know, whatever the moment is. And I would think that was incredible. But I was like holding my breath all day because I couldn't let myself bathe in the impossibility of what we were doing. So it was, you know, and the young cast was so helpful because as brilliant as they are, and they f***ing are, they were game as hell to do the best possible job. And I think they were as inspired by the original cast as the original cast was inspired by the young cast.
The Force, it's calling to you. Just let it in.
Well, thanks to Ollie for that contribution and that conversation. Emily, are you going to go and see Star Wars?
Yes, I have somehow managed to avoid spoilers, but I'm going to see it this weekend, so hopefully I can remain spoiler-free by not looking at the internet or talking to anybody I meet.
James, you remain sceptical.
But we've done a lot of Star Wars here at Wired over the last month, and I'll go see it eventually, but I figure that there's people that want to see it way more than me, so I'll let them go first.
it's very noble of you. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I'm going to go see it tonight. I might take a secret lightsaber and just break it out halfway through and start swishing it around.
And a bacon sandwich.
Exactly. Well, enjoy your mass culture participation, everybody. Have a great break and a happy new year, and we'll speak to you again next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.